Okay. Well, I'm Corinne White. I'm here on Friday, September 27th, 2013, in Carrboro, North Carolina. And today I'm interviewing Mr. Daniel Leonard. I'm just going to start out with a quick question about if you could tell me a little bit about what you remember from your childhood and what your favorite childhood memories are.
Oh, interesting question. As a child, I lived in rural Davidson County in a parsonage on a secondary road. There was a large woods across the street, and I loved to go over there and explore. Anytime I walked near a branch or a creek, I would fall in, but that didn't bother me. It bothered my mother, I think, but it wasn't very deep. I couldn't have drowned. And the land next door, there was a working farm. And sometimes I had a friend who was the grandson of that farmer. And sometimes I would go over there and look around and see things and look at the mules and watch the pigs and the pig waller and that sort of thing. And even rode on the combine a few times. And another person lives across the street, and this is young. That was Mr. Myers. And diagonally across the street was Mr. and Mrs. Young. I remember her. That's how I got to know what a southern country woman was like. Mm-hmm. Pleasant lady, very nice. And when Queen Elizabeth II was coronated, they didn't have videotapes in those days. So they would make a film and then fly it across to the United States and then show it on television. So she would let me come over to her house and look at the films of the coronation. So that's one of my big childhood memories. And my father was, at that time, was the minister of Emmanuel Evangelical and Reformed Church, which is now United Church of Christ, there in rural Davidson County.
What were your memories of the church like?
Ah, interesting. The original church was the traditional turn-of-the-century white clapboard church with a mm-hmm. steeple. The heat source was two giant wood stoves in the front of the church. My father added the idea of putting big floor fans behind the stove, pointed to the ceiling, so it would force the hot air to come back to the people that weren't right next to the mm-hmm. stove. I jokingly refer to my father as having an edifice complex because everywhere we went, something was built. At that church, they built the parsonage that we lived in, the Christian Education Building, and a new sanctuary while we were there. And we were there from, I want to say, 47 to 54. So Daddy was busy.
Do you still consider yourself to be a Christian, or is that something that's no longer part of your life?
I guess I would say, as some Catholics would say they were lapsed Catholics, and mm-hmm. Jews would say they're non-observant, I would guess I would say I'm a non-practicing, Protestant Christian. I do not attend any church, and I guess the last time I went to church regularly was, I don't know, in the 96, 97, something like that. So I would just say I maintain my Christian beliefs, but I'm not active with any church.
Mm-hmm. So from your childhood, what do you think brought you to attend UNC? And you were trying to go to medical school, right? That was the goal?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I went... Well, first I graduated from Catawba College. Mm-hmm. I took pre-med, but I didn't make very good grades. I was pleasantly surprised that I was accepted, considering my performance in college. I actually think it was my letters of recommendation that did it versus my grades. So I came to Chapel Hill to go to medical school. And at the same time, I was dealing with my homosexuality, my gayness. And I couldn't do both at the same time. I was too psychologically conflicted because, you know, being gay and being a doctor was just totally unheard of in those days. And so I entered therapy in the spring of 66. And I've been in therapy off and on all my adult life for various reasons at different times. So I ended up, as I would say, I didn't flunk out of medical school. I passed out of medical school. That is, my QPA was not high enough to continue. I didn't make any F's, but had a lot of D's.
Mm-hmm.
And so that made my QPA too low.
Mm-hmm. What do you think got you interested in the medical professions?
That's interesting. I had gone through various decisions.
Mm-hmm.
First, I thought about, like in about the eighth grade, I thought about becoming a nurse, and then in those days that wasn't really on for men. So then I thought about becoming a pharmacist, and then by the time I graduated from high school, I wanted to be a doctor. I assume the influences were, I was a sickly child, the positive interactions with doctors who took care of me.
Mm-hmm. Where do you think the attitude that gay doctors were unheard of came from, and that men couldn't be nurses? Where do you think those ideas came from?
Well, it was just the prevailing attitude in 1965-66. Someone actually told me in my exit interview at the medical school, I had to go see the school psychiatrist, and I was told that gay men cannot be doctors. That was the official opinion of the school. Yet I knew one gay physician. So I knew this wasn't absolutely true. After I left medical school, I worked as a research technician in the pathology department, and then I became a graduate student in the pathology department and got my master's degree in 74. And about nursing, well, you know, as I mentioned, nursing was something I thought of earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I finished, I'm getting tired of my dead-end bureaucratic job at the university, I decided I wanted to do something that was flexible and portable and didn't require a large amount of capital. And so I decided to become a nurse. And I like working with people. So that's what I did.
Mm-hmm.
Went to Alamance Community College
to
get my associate degree in nursing. Since I already had a bachelor's and a master's, I wanted to vary up my kinds of degrees.
Yeah, I got to get all the different letters. So 74 was also when you started the CGA, right?
Yes, yes. Mike Grissom and I, he had come here from Princeton as a graduate student in political science.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, I had been active with the Human Sexuality Information and Counseling Service since 72, so 72 to 74. And he got in touch with me, and we talked about starting a gay group here.
Mm-hmm.
I think he came in the fall of 73.
Mm-hmm.
The spring of 74, we did a lot of organizational meetings and then filled out the paperwork in the summer of 74, slightly after I graduated, and the group started meeting officially in the fall of 74.
Yes. So why do you think you two made good leaders for this group, and what was the impetus to form it at that time?
Well, you know, Stonewall had occurred in 1969, yeah. and the reverberations had reached here by then. There had been previous groups in this area. There was one in Raleigh, not associated with NC State, and there was one at Duke, which I think has existed off and on for many years, although the group that started out as CGA has gone through several name changes, but has continuously existed since that time. Me and a woman who was in the organization from the 80s are trying to get our ducks in a row and get organized and have a 40th anniversary reunion in the fall of 74. That actually depends on the football schedule, which is not currently available.
Oh, no.
So, because we didn't want to have it on a football Saturday because people might want to come and stay in a hotel and
yes.
Da da da. Of course, now we have a Carborough hotel, which has. I don't think Carborough has ever had a hotel historically. Mm-hmm. I'd have to check the record. I was on the Appearance Commission and the Historic District Commission here for a while. I certainly don't know of one either historically or during the time mm-hmm. I was there. Now, there may be, in the early 20th century, there may have been rooming houses,
mm-hmm.
but I don't think there's ever been a hotel per se.
So when you were starting the CGA, do you think you were starting it more for political or social reasons?
Aha. I conceived of it as three prongs. You hit on two of them. Political. Personal growth, which was mm-hmm. my interest coming from the Human Sexuality Information and mm-hmm. Counseling Service, and social.
Mm-hmm.
And we spent. So initially, Mike was interested in political.
Mm-hmm.
The social was sort of a given, and we evolved how to do that, because you can't use student funds for social activities.
Yeah.
So we did it I think somebody fronted it the first time, and then we would collect money every time we had a social event and then use it to fund the next event and so forth. In those days, and I was interested in personal growth, we had... at least for the first couple of years, we had what I call consciousness-raising groups,
mm-hmm.
where people of 10 to 12 people would meet once a week for 10 weeks out of a semester
mm-hmm.
and have sort of... There was no formal program, and at the end of the previous meeting... we would decide by consensus what we wanted to discuss the next time.
Okay.
But you didn't have to stay on the topic and, you know. And it was, I think it was an excellent idea. I think it was a great way for people to understand themselves as well as the diversity of the gay community. Early on, there were no lesbians involved. Within the first year or two, the first lesbian showed up.
Mm-hmm.
Her name is Susan Johnston. Now, is that with a T or without a T? I can never remember. But that's... although not at that time, within not too many years, it had lesbian... CGA changed it to have lesbian in the title. My acquaintance from the 80s, she introduced Be Glad, which she thought was the greatest idea. But B is bisexual, gay, lesbian, and I don't know what the AD stood for. And early in those early days, I think by 97, I'm guessing. No, I don't mean 97. By 77, we had our first Southeastern Gay Conference that was hosted here. It was the brainchild of Tom Carr, C-A-R-R, who was a graduate student in botany. He came. We used to have a Tuesday night social, not a conscience raising group, but just to get together and chat. He brought full blown out of his head the master plan for having the a Southeastern Gay Conference, which we pulled off, and I think that met here for 2 years, or maybe it met here 1 year, and then met in Atlanta, and then came back here. I forget the details of that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and Tom, single-handedly went to the Chapel Hill Town Council and got an ordinance passed for equality hiring by the town. He just did this. I mean, not that any of us objected, but he just did it.
Wow. So what did that policy look like, the equality hiring? Was that non-discrimination?
Yes. Okay. It was non-discrimination in municipal hiring.
Okay.
Not for the university and not for private business, but just municipal hiring.
Do you think that was a big step in making Chapel Hill more gay-friendly?
I don't know. That's an interesting question. Mm-hmm. It sort of happened. There wasn't a big campaign to do it. And since it was so limited in scope, it didn't seem like a big deal at the time.
Yeah.
So, we were glad he did it, but it didn't seem to be a big deal. He and a woman decided one day that they were going to walk down the street holding hands to demonstrate being gay and lesbian. And we all laughed and said, huh? Huh? A man and a woman walking down the street holding hands. Hello? That won't work. and they said, oh, yes, of course. So that was, you know, the things I remember. What was the original question?
That's fine. I wanted to go back and talk about your experience working with the Human Sexuality and Information and Counseling Services.
Okay.
So what was your role with that, and what kind of students and questions would you interact with?
Okay. I joined that group in the spring semester of 72.
Mm-hmm.
It was founded in the fall semester of 71.
Mm-hmm.
It turned out that at the meeting I went to, there had been one gay man there in the fall. Turned out that I think I was one of two gay men that were trainees, and one bisexual man who was a trainee. And sort of by, we were all trained as general sexuality counselors, and we would take phone shifts and sit in the office. We had this giant notebook of resources for questions. But we had some degrees of specialization. So I became the homosexuality go-to person, more or less. And for instance, there were some people, various classes, the ones I remember predominantly were in physical education, who wanted someone to come and talk about gayness.
Mm-hmm.
So I did a couple of those, and maybe some other classes that I don't remember. And then there was a, this was just on the cusp of Roe versus Wade.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the women were abortion counselors.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them lives diagonally across the street. Known her for all these years. So they would make arrangements. They would counsel with the women and so on and so forth, and make arrangements for them to go out of state to get an abortion.
Wow. So what was the nature of these presentations you were giving to the classes? That's kind of interesting.
Oh, gosh. Just general information about being gay.
Mm-hmm.
And as I recall, a lot of what I said, depended on the class, the questions that the class asked.
And did was it arranged such that students could come to you and personally ask you questions?
Well, at the counseling service, yes.
Okay.
I would entertain questions after class,
mm-hmm.
as most professors or speakers would do. But the majority of that kind of thing was at the counseling service office.
Mm-hmm. And did a lot of students come to you, or was it not that many, or?
Gosh, it's hard to tell. I would not say I was overwhelmed.
Yeah.
Occasionally.
Mm-hmm. And did most students come to you with questions about their identity or about health, physical health, or what was kind of?
Well, in general, there were sexually transmissible mm-hmm. disease questions, contraception questions, mm-hmm. and so forth. The questions that came to me about gayness, one instance I can remember, this guy came to me for, on some, in retrospect, obvious, in obvious pretense, and in the discussion he said, "Do you think I'm gay?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Why? Why, how do you know that I'm gay?" I said, your eyes are soft, not hard. And that's probably a prejudice, but that's what I said. And can't remember his name. I think his last name was Borrell, from the eastern part of the state. That's the only one I can remember, and there might have been some others that I don't remember at all.
So what went into the consciousness-raising sessions that were part of the CGA? You said there was usually a discussion topic, and then would the whole group talk about it together, or?
Yeah, each group had a facilitator.
Okay.
I facilitated one of the groups each term. One of the graduate students in psych, David Halterwanger,
mm-hmm.
Facilitated some of the groups. I think in subsequent years, I'm not sure who the facilitators were. One of them may have been Howard Fredkin,
mm-hmm.
who has his degree in counseling psychology from here. He has spent his professional career working with gay men who have been sexually traumatized. He works in, his practice is in Columbus, Ohio.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of topics would the consciousness-raising sessions cover?
Oh, that's, now you ask. I don't have any specific recollections of what the topics were. I'm only guessing we probably touched on religion. I remember having a medical student once come to a general meeting, not a conscience-raising meeting, and talk about sexually transmissible diseases. But I really don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
As I say, it was the agenda was set by the members, so it was essentially what the participants wanted to talk about.
Mm-hmm. And you said that the CGA for the first few years was all male.
Mm-hmm.
Was there any sort of racial diversity or socioeconomic diversity in that group?
Well, Lord knows, we all thought we were poor back then. I don't, as to socioeconomic, I have no data on that. I think that it probably reflected the general socioeconomic spectrum of the university, of people who were not in fraternities. I don't recall, if anyone was attended who was in a fraternity, they never said so. What was the other part of that question?
Any racial diversity?
Okay, and we did, now I forget which year, in the first couple of years, perhaps not. But within the first 5 years, yes, there, oh, wait a minute. Judge Darrell Hancock, got involved. He is now a Superior Court judge in Rowan County. He was the DA there for many years and then became a judge. There were a few others, I think.
Mm-hmm. A lot of student groups nowadays on campus kind of work with other groups on campus. Did the CGA work with other groups in particular?
No, I would say not.
You would say not?
Remember, we were the odd people out.
Mm-hmm.
So, other than the roots from the human sexuality,
mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say we did, no.
Mm-hmm. So what was overall visibility on campus of the CGA like?
Ah, okay. You know when rush occurs in the fall, and all those fraternities and mm-hmm. sororities put up rush notices.
Mm-hmm.
So one year, I don't have a copy of this. It might be in the Carolina collection, I don't know. Someone designed and made a poster that had lambda, lambda, lambda on it, and it says, rush to CGA. And there were, you know, those two big pillars at the beginning of the steps in front of Wilson Library? They put one on each of those big pillars facing the quad. of course, how often they had to be replaced, I don't know. But and we would write on the cube in those days was literally a cube. It didn't have more, it only had four faces. notices about events and meetings were painted on the cube.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not saying every meeting or, but anyways, sometimes notices were painted on the cube.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a newsletter within the first couple of years. I think the first editor was Larry Brown.
Was this Lambda?
Yes.
Okay.
So you know about that. And,
mm-hmm.
Okay.
I've read a few of them.
Okay. And you will know. I was interviewed by a journalism student once,
mm-hmm.
and he brought copies of some Lambda stuff, and he said, "Did you write this?" And I, because we, being not wanting to be totally, totally public and put our names on everything, people would write articles but not sign them.
Mm-hmm.
So I read the article, and he said, "Did you write this article?" I said, "Well, it sounds like something I would have written." and that was another way to, Lambda was printed and left about, you know, I guess in the student union, I don't know where else.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a way of getting people to know who we were about. Early, I want to step back. Early in the formational stages, that is the spring of 73, we met in the Catholic Student Center,
mm-hmm.
which sounds totally radical. We met in the Catholic Student Center because the priest there, Father Tom Palko,
mm-hmm.
was gay friendly. And so he permitted us to meet there. We also met at the Lutheran Student Center, which is since, which used to be the parsonage, became a student center, and it has since been torn down. It was there, you know, the Lutheran church downtown. It was behind the church. I think they tore it, either they tore it down and made it into a parking, more parking, or they replaced it with some building related to the church. But that building is no longer there. Although the Newman Student Center is still there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting that in the South, a gay group started in religious facilities.
What does it mean to you to be from the South and be a Southerner? Because I've kind of, in some of the other interviews that I've listened to, with gay men from, like, the Chapel Hill community, they've said a lot about kind of how it being gay, like, clashes with part of Southern identity. Have you experienced any of that at all?
Yes and no. Mostly no. I was, in spite of rampant discrimination in those days, and I was probably obviously gay to everyone since I was five, but I didn't know it. And although I was occasionally harassed or bullied in high school, it wasn't a big deal, to me anyway. I remember it, if that. And having been, as you see on there, both my parents have college educations, and the Evangelical and Reformed Church, and sort of now the United Church of Christ even more, is very liberal. So there wasn't a lot of negative talk in church about gay men and lesbians. Of course, it wasn't talked about
mm-hmm.
by anybody anywhere. So to say it wasn't discussed is to say that it was the social norm. I guess... Oh, and I'm a half-breed. My mother's a Yankee. I was always... that's a strong word. Often, especially in elementary school, started school in a 12th grade country school in Davidson County, and I'm not absolutely sure, but I would guess that my parents were two of the few parents at that school who had graduated from college. And so it was mostly rural. The children were children of farmers or factory workers or so forth. And I just didn't fit in. I talked, since my parents were college educated, I talked like my parents talk and not like country Southern people talk. So that got me being odd right off. And so being odd or different from such an early age was sort of normative for me, that I never fit the mainstream anyway. And as I say, negative statements about homosexuality were not made because it wasn't discussed. So I knew I was, from a youngish age, I don't know, 10, 12, whatever, I realized that I was not like other boys, but I had no idea what that meant. I just knew I was different. And one thing that happened in elementary school, some of these country boys who were of a poor background, I believe, actually, they started picking on me, or today they'd probably call it bullying. And I told my parents about it. My parents had a brilliant idea, and it worked. Mother roasted a bunch of peanuts, and I took them in a brown sack to school and shared them with these guys. They stopped bothering me. And I wouldn't say it was a bribe. I think it was a gesture of friendship or something. And that always sticks with me, that there are ways to deal with discrimination and bullying that are positive as opposed to rebellious. Anyway, I felt that I was different from a youngish age, but I didn't necessarily feel discriminated against because it wasn't discussed.
Mm-hmm. So when did it start being discussed?
Huh. You know, by me? I mean, about me or in general?
I guess both.
Okay. About, because of the teasing, bullying, harassment that occurred in high school, that was, in retrospect, that was probably because I was gay, but I didn't know it.
Mm-hmm.
And like guys putting their crotch in my face in the locker room, and with or without their clothes on, things like that. It's hard to say whether I evolved or the society evolved. Then when I went away to college, it was an opportunity to meet other young men who were also interested in young men. So that still was a no-no, and I knew it was a no-no, but I did it anyway. And it turned out a person who was 3 years behind me in school got thrown out of college because he was having consecutive sexual visitors in his dorm room on some evening or other. Maybe I graduated soon enough. Because in college, my frequency of male contacts increased over time. So maybe I graduated soon enough to avoid his fate. And maybe I had better sense than to do what he did. And then I came to Chapel Hill. Of course, I'd heard from the time I was a teen. This was the summer of 65, that, you know, there was a queer and a communist behind every tree at UNC. Well, I soon learned that although I never saw anyone that I knew to be a communist, how do you see a communist? But anyway, I didn't see any communists, I wasn't aware of any communists, but it soon dawned on me that there were other gay men around. And so I got into that scene. And of course, and we talked about this earlier, and so that both time-wise and emotionally led me to do badly, very badly in medical school.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever come into confrontation with any gay stereotypes or thought about those at all?
Me personally?
Mm-hmm.
as I say, I'm new for a long time that I was me. I knew that I was different. Any gay stereotypes? I'm really not sure. Other than the obvious statement about the psychiatrist at the medical school that gay men can't be doctors.
Mm-hmm.
I think looking back on this, and damnation, I did not thank him while he was living. The faculty advisor to the medical class of 1969, which is the class I was in, I think was a I won't say mentor. What is the right word? A person operating in the background to help me organize my life. I mean, when I left medical school, he helped me find a job, although I didn't realize it. I mean, the people I worked for were next door, right next door to his lab. And then many years after I finished my master's degree, while I was finishing, I left pathology and went and worked in the Department of Medicine for a year, and then I got an opportunity to work in the preclinical teaching facility at UNC. It's called Berry Hill Hall. I've heard it is still in operation. But the vice dean or the associate dean for basic medical education was the director of that facility, and guess what? He was the man who was the class advisor to the class of 1969. So, you know, maybe he was working on my behalf in the background all those years. By the time it dawned on me, he was sickly, and before I got up the nerve to speak to him about it, he passed away.
Mm-hmm.
In the last, last 3 years or so. His name was Dr. William Davis Huffines.
So when I was listening to your first interview, you said another one of the reasons that you worked to find the CGA was because you wanted kind of another outlet for gay men to meet each other that
socially, yes.
To meet each other socially that didn't involve alcohol or kind of like the tea room
right. Cruising
scene.
Exactly. Yeah.
What kind of flaws did you find with the way that gay men were able to meet each other before the CGA came about?
A basic premise of mine was that gay bars and tea rooms are not for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
They have their negative aspects. For bars, it's obviously the alcohol and the cigarette smoke, which is now illegal. And the tea rooms was a very surreptitious kind of closety, hidden behavior, and people just didn't. I didn't think of it. I never want to say that X is bad for everybody, but certainly tea rooms and bars were not the best thing for everybody. For individuals, there's some variability, but in a group dynamic, I think it's better.
Mm-hmm.
To meet in a social setting with other people that you know are gay. And
mm-hmm. Had you ever heard of students coming to the Human Information and Sexuality Counseling Services with maybe complaints about the ways that there were to meet people or anything like that?
I would be making it up if I said yes,
uh-huh.
But it's certainly highly possible.
Mm-hmm. And apart from the bars, there was kind of, I read a little bit about, like, the dinner party circuits and then the Friendly Castle.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I'd love to hear more about those if you...
Okay, now the dinner party circuit, that's interesting. And to my memory, the dinner party circuit was, there was this, maybe because I was, I don't know which came first, the chicken or egg. Maybe it was because I was an outspoken activist, was never invited to these upper echelon dinner parties. So I can't really address that. I mean, of course, we had dinner parties. I remember one time, my partner at that time, and I hosted what turned out to be a 12-hour Thanksgiving dinner. people were to arrive at 2 p.m. We would eat when it was ready. And then we went on a long walk to walk that off and came back and then ate some more. And so I think the last person left at 2 a.m. You know? but that was the exception. Now, what other part of that? You said the dinner?
In Friendly Castle.
Oh, Friendly Castle. Okay. Friendly Castle was, I forget what street it's on. It's some lane downtown. It may have been engulfed by one of the sororities by building back onto this lane. I don't think it's there anymore. The primary residents of Friendly Castle were Ned Rice, his lover Jim, I can't think of Jim's last name, and Randy something, and Charlie Delmar, who was an older man. Charlie Delmar may have owned the house, but I'm not sure he lived there. And Hoagy Gaskins.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Hoagy Gaskins was my first acquaintance to die of AIDS, mm-hmm, in 1983. Ned Rice died the year before of a massive heart attack. Actually, since I worked in pathology, I went to talk to the chief medical examiner and said, could you take a retrospective look at the slides from Ned's? Because Ned died in a public place of a massive heart attack, so he had to be autopsied. Would he look at the slides of his thymus to see if there were any known early signs of those days of HIV infection? And Dr. Hudson looked at the slides and told me that, well, now that you bring it up, maybe. the state of knowledge at that time was not very large. So that Ned lived there, and then Hoagy Gaskins, Hoagy Gaskins was diagnosed at a time when no one knew what to do. I mean, professionally, the medical people did not know what to do for a person with AIDS. They tried lots of things in good faith, but that didn't work. I remember when he died, because since I worked in the medical center, I would try to go walk over to his room almost every day to just say hi. And then a mutual friend of ours who was a nurse in the hospital or in the clinics, anyway, called me one day and said, Ned has died. And I said, have they removed the body? And he said, no. So I walked over there and looked in his room, and there he was, dead. Now, this is after the time, I don't know what year this occurred, but I know from being a nurse, it wasn't protocol when I was working as a nurse. You don't cover the face of the dead in the hospital. So the door was open. He looked like he was asleep, but he was dead. And I guess that's why they stopped that sheet business. But I had several days before he died, and in retrospect, I know why he did that. He said, "I'm drowning, I'm drowning." Well, what happened was he had PCP, and his lungs were filling up with fluid. So that made him feel like he was drowning. But, you know, they didn't know.
Mm-hmm. So what were the social gatherings at Friendly Castle like?
Oh, they were... Well, they were the standard equivalent of a college community gathering. you know, beer, soft drinks, and snacks.
Mm-hmm.
And people would stand around and talk. And so on. Music was played. Was there any dancing? I don't remember.
Mm-hmm. Was it mostly gay men who attended that?
Mostly gay men, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't recall any women, but there might have been a few.
Mm-hmm. What were the gay bars in Chapel Hill? Like, there was the Pegasus and then Tempo Room, was it?
Yes, yes, yes. The Tempo Room is still, it has another name.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the middle of downtown Chapel Hill, but you have to walk down. It's a basement level kind of thing. I don't know what the current name of it is, but
is
I think...
Is that the cave?
In the center of downtown.
Oh, huh.
Not far from the old Rathskeller, along in that area of the block. I think it's still there. I have no idea what the name of it is. And it's not a gay bar. And there was one of the bartenders there. They served nice sandwiches, and one of the bartenders there was a big black man named Tracy. He made the most wonderful rare beef roast beef sandwiches one could ever eat. And it was one of those transition bars, and that is, until 9:30, 10 o'clock, it was straight or mixed. And then the rest of the evening, it was gay.
Mm-hmm.
But interestingly enough, there were some people who, as far as we knew, were not gay, but stayed anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, three or four.
Mm-hmm.
And then it burned, I say, under mysterious circumstances. And, you know, I think the owner wanted it for insurance. Then the, quote-unquote, the gay bar moved down around the corner. I don't know what the name of it was. It's right there near the Presbyterian Student Center,
mm-hmm.
along there on Henderson Street. We all called it the Temporary because the tempo... which was the one downtown, had closed. And we called it the Temporary because we thought the Tempo was going to reopen. It never did. And then the Pegasus was on West Franklin,
mm-hmm.
where the cave or something is,
mm-hmm.
now. And the owner, manager of that was the second person I knew who died of AIDS. He died in 84, because Hoagie died in 83.
Mm-hmm.
And he and other people, I was in on these discussions, were trying to mount a gay-related response to the epidemic. He had a big house over on, I forget which street it is, in Durham. Might be Duke Street. And we talked about what could be done. And at mm-hmm. that, interesting to note, a physician's assistant said, "Well, the only thing we could do at our place would be chest X-rays and white blood counts, looking for, you know, a low number of T lymphocytes, of lymphocytes, because they hadn't distinguished, at least on a practical level, between the different kinds of T cells." So he said, "Well, that's about all we can do as far as diagnosis is concerned. And we have no idea what the treatment is. At least by that time, they got to the point where this was a year after Hoagie died, is, well, we don't know what to do, as opposed mm-hmm. to saying, oh, let's try everything.
Mm-hmm. So there was no testing available for HIV?
No. Mm-hmm. That didn't come until, I would say, 86.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of awareness did people have of how HIV spread in the early?
Oh, God, there were 9,000 different rumors. Mm-hmm. Some of it was, in retrospect, completely wrong. Because now it is known that the incubation period can be hugely long. I mean, years and years. Mm-hmm. And so people, you would ask somebody how they think they got the disease, and they would say, oh, I got it in Washington 2 years ago. But now that doesn't make any sense. I mean, because these people were fully sick.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, oh, they got it 2 years ago in a big city.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was about it. I remember the CDC tried to do, when Hoagie died, one of their classic clinical approaches to an epidemic is to look at people who were friends of the deceased, who had social factors in common, but did not have the disease. Well, for this time element, who knew? I mean, they may or may not have been mm-hmm. exposed. And also, they did have the sense enough to say, and had never been a sexual partner of the deceased. They couldn't find any people who were similar, like people who lived in Friendly Castle, who had a similar social background, and they would look for somebody of a similar social background who did not have the disease and who had never had sex with the subject. They couldn't find one. They couldn't find there's a name for that, a case control group or something like that. Mm-hmm. They couldn't find one. And given the long incubation period, it probably wouldn't have demonstrated anything anyway because they didn't have a test.
Mm-hmm. When these two friends of yours were diagnosed, was there any sort of scare in the community about, like, maybe we should be safer or maybe we should cut back or?
That's interesting. I'll share with you my personal response.
Mm-hmm.
My personal response was to reduce my number of sexual partners, which had...
going on? Okay.
It was mostly acquired locally. It was not acquired locally, and it was acquired from people who had visited or lived in big cities like New York, L.A., San Francisco. And I think, in retrospect, I was right at that point in time, although, because it's, epidemic spread. And so we were so close to the beginning that the likelihood of people, of gay men in an academic community in North Carolina having the disease was quite low. And maybe that is why I've always been HIV negative.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's miraculous. And there's also the possibility, there are people, I've never been tested for this because my insurance wouldn't pay for it. There is a test. There are some gay men, or some men, who have a unique protein that keeps the HIV virus from entering their cells. That has been discovered in the last, I don't know, 5 or 10 years. So maybe I have that protein.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's been a mystery to me for mm-hmm. quite a while.
So when did the move kind of for safe sex and other precautions began?
Oh, gosh. I don't remember. It certainly was after I was involved in CGA. Mm-hmm. I would say, See, the test was available in 86. So I would say around 86. And, of course, I remember one of the evolutions. At first they said safe sex, and then they got smart and said safer sex. But that, I would, in retrospect, I would say was probably around the time of the advent of the test. And yet you may have read, some gay men continue to be upset that we cannot be blood donors. We cannot be blood or organ donors. And that is a public health policy for the greater good. Now, who's to say that every gay man who's had sex with another man since some year they chose, like 1975 or something, has HIV? Well, they don't all. And there is now a test. But the problem is the test is a screening test that looks, but it's cheap, looks at for the antibody, that is the body's reaction to the virus, as opposed to the virus itself. So the test for the virus itself is much more accurate than the antibody test. So although other countries have either never adopted or have stopped that ban, I don't think it, I think it's unlikely in the United States, although I understand why people are upset about it. It's, as I say, having a health background, it's one of those greater good things.
So thinking about kind of the United States and even the South as a whole, what kind of, has the gay rights movement met your expectations at all or gone higher or lower?
Oh, gosh. I am shocked. Pleasantly. You know, at the time of the founding of CGA, we were concerned about just being treated fairly, not being discriminated against, etc. Now, I don't think the idea of gay marriage even crossed anybody's mind. I don't think it ever, no one ever thought of that. So I think now that, I mean, we have states that have gay marriage and the District of Columbia, it's, you know, so we have accomplished a lot more than we ever imagined. And back then, and we've had it added to the movement, bisexuals and transgendered people. And so I don't think back then we even, there was a great deal of skepticism about bisexuality being real at all, and that bisexuality was a transition phase. And no one thought anything about rights for the transgendered. So we've come to that. And there, there's recently been a group formed at the Chapel Senior Center for lesbian, gay, LGBT, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered people who are senior citizens. So, we have yet to have any people we know to be transgendered, and no one has said that they were bi. And so I think we're mostly gay men and lesbians. However, in my opinion, IMHO, a successfully transgendered person would not be public about it. You know, why? Why go to all that hormonal and surgical trouble to then be publicly known to be a trans person.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I have a couple of trans friends on Facebook, and I've learned a lot from them.
Mm-hmm.
I swear that this trans man, he's going to die of the hormones. I mean, I know someone who did die from taking testosterone for years and years and years. But he did it right because no one knew,
mm-hmm.
except me and his mother. I'm exaggerating, but that the teenager I knew as Carol then became the man Carol, you just added another L, and married. And but he died, oh gosh, I'm guessing 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But he knew the risk.
Mm-hmm.
He was a hospital lab person. He knew the risk of taking all those the testosterone for years and years, that he would die of a heart attack, and he did while mowing the grass.
So do you think kind of the move towards being more inclusive, how has that impacted the movement?
Oh, well, I'm sure there are purists who would say, oh, no, we can't have any of this, mm-hmm. especially the trans part. Well, they're just, no, let them do their own thing. But I think it's part of the broader, I accept it as part of the broader sexual liberation movement.
Mm-hmm.
That you know, people are free to be who they want to be and don't need to be judged by others.
Mm-hmm. What was it like? I noticed the Amendment 1 sign on the porch.
Yes.
What was that like for you when the amendment did pass?
Well, I was not happy, of course. I was also a realist. Someone says, oh, we've got to have this repealed. We've got to have this repealed. And somebody put that on Facebook. And I said, really? Do you know how long it takes to repeal an amendment to the state or federal constitution?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Lord knows. And it has to be voted on by the Congress and then by every state. And, well, no, in this case, it wouldn't be the Congress, but it had to be voted on by the people and the legislature, and it would take forever. And, of course, I don't even think there's a movement afoot. At least it's very small.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't heard of it. I keep that sign just to remind people this is something that needs to be worked on. Of course, I was unhappy. My partner Nathan and I actually we are engaged, but we haven't, because of the lack of recognition between states of same-sex
mm-hmm.
marriage, we would probably not get married until we move to a state that has same-sex
mm-hmm.
marriage. And this house is much too big for two of us. And we will, you know, in X number of years, we will give this up and hopefully move to an equality marriage state.
Mm-hmm. So have you thought of, what's kept you in North Carolina then, do you think?
Good question. I had said for years that I wouldn't move out of the state until my mother died. Well, my mother died in 1999, and I'm still here.
Mm-hmm.
So, and of course, living in Southern Orange County, you might as well live in San Francisco as far as discrimination is concerned. There's not a big push to go there. But if we're going to sell this house, buy a smaller house, why not do it in a state? Since we're both retired, why not do it in a state that has equality of marriage?
Do you think it's ever a possibility for North Carolina or to have it equal marriage?
My feeling, I'm reflecting what other people have said, and I agree with them. It will not, the state, well, it may be forever. I'd hate to say never, but it'll be a long time. However, some people have said that they think the answer would be a federal uniform, you know, a uniform law that covers all states. And then that would subsume North Carolina. But as far as North Carolina doing it independently, I think that's way, way off.
Totally forgot what I was going to say. How do you think life would have been different for you if you had been a grad student at Chapel Hill today instead of in the 70s? Like, how's the community changed?
Well, see, that's a good question because I'm not involved in that community anymore. good question. Well, I get the impression today that as far as time requirements on one's time to do graduate school, although I did it, I took one course at a time. That's why it took me so many years. Is essentially not much different. That is the time requirement of the graduate student, unless they're doing it very part-time like I did. I'm not sure they have a lot of time to explore a lot of gay social activities that we didn't opportunities that exist now may, this is my opinion, may be no in the percentage of gay men and lesbians involved, it's probably no different now than then because of the requirements, the time requirements to be a graduate student. Now, people can certainly be more open. They have more opportunities to get involved if they have the time. I mean, it probably is different, but I don't perceive exactly how.
And then another thing I wanted to ask was, did you ever have student boarders that stayed with you?
Yes. Oh, I must have mentioned that in one of those tapes. Yes. Yes. Actually, it turns out, that was my intent of buying, when I bought such a big house. My intent, actually, I don't think, my intent was to rent to students. But as it turned out, I only think I had one student for one semester who's a graduate student in psychology. And the other ones were people who worked around.
Trying to keep from inflating his ego too much. I have to live with it.
What was I saying?
The student boarder.
Okay. Yes, we had, I had one, the other guys were people who worked in this area, who worked in this area, had a guy, a long-term tenant who was a waiter downtown, had another long-term tenant who worked in the radiology department at the medical school, but yeah, as I say, to my memory, only one of my tenants was ever a full-time student.
And with like the student boarder system, was it usually that, was it a way for gay students to have a safe place to live? Was it just more any student who wanted to have somewhere to live? Like I was kind of
Well, as I say, there was only one student.
Yeah, but I think other people and the community would have student voters.
That's interesting. I don't know their motives. I would say, well, they were all gay,
mm-hmm.
so maybe they wanted to live cheaply around other gay people. I mean, the rent was not outrageous, and they each had their own room and a shared bath and invisible kitchen privileges. That's interesting. Invisible kitchen privileges is, I don't want you in there in my way, and if you're in there and use the kitchen, clean up after yourself so I can't see you've been there. but that's interesting. You actually have to ask one of them, Jake Helderman, who lives here in town. He's now retired from the Department of Radiology, but works there part time. I assume it was to, as I mentioned, to have a gay-friendly place to live that wasn't very expensive.
Mm-hmm. And what other kind of activism have you been involved with? Do you consider your work as a nurse to be activist? Do you ever help other gay people with issues of public health?
Let me see. Let me go back. I'll do it chronologically.
Okay.
I have over the years, I've been involved in various aspects of the human rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in college in the 60s, it was civil rights. And then it was gay rights, then it was inmate rights, patient rights, and then when I became a psychiatric nurse, it became mental health rights, and now that I'm into this senior gay group, now it's senior gay rights. nursing per se, I'm always willing, and perhaps too willing, to answer questions about health in general or gay-related health and mental health. And there's one of my Facebook friends who I friended because he was outed when he was in the Navy and was there. That was during Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So he was dismissed from the Navy, and he's become a big activist in that area, and in the area of ending the bullying of children. And unfortunately, in the past few months, I noticed this, and I checked with some other people, and they noticed it too. His postings became diffuse. They didn't make any sense. I usually would send him PMs. Sometimes I would send him an open message. Sometimes I would send him a PM message. Are you all right? And et cetera. I found out just the other day from his sister, who's on his, because he hadn't posted in a week. His sister, and he usually posts at least once a day. His sister was listed as one of his friends. So I contacted her and asked her what she knew, and he's been admitted to the hospital. And I said, is it for mental health and or substance abuse? And she said both, because it was her opinion that he was into cocaine or something else. But I became friends with him to support him in his activism. And I had no idea he would turn into what I call e-patients. Electronic patients I have never examined, I've never talked to in person. And I would say E there stands for, as well as electronic, it also stands for encourager. In other words, I encourage these people to take care of themselves, to seek appropriate treatment, etc.
Well, is there anything else that I didn't ask about that you wanted to bring up or think that it's important?
Oh, well, that covers a lot of it. We didn't... the issue of gay marriage is interesting to me, but it's not a, as I mentioned earlier, it's not a hot-button issue. It's not something I want to march up and down the street about every day. It's interesting to be in this older LGBT group because a lot of these people are around my age. One time, at one meeting, we meet the second and fourth Thursdays, a woman showed up in a wheelchair, 91 years old, and we were talking about what kind of activities we want to involve in. She says, I want to have a dance. And that was so cool. I just thought it was wonderful that she had the spunk to want to do that. She also mentioned that in the early days of the epidemic, she was involved in needle exchange program on the streets in the north. Hmm. You know, taking back dirty syringes and giving them clean ones.
Wow.
So there's a lot of ancient knowledge to be gained from the people in this group. If you know of a student who wants a project, assuming that people are willing to talk, it involves talking with older gay men and lesbians, I could certainly bring it up and saying, you know, X is doing a study, and if you want to talk with them, this is their email address, you know.
Oh, great. Yeah. I'm sure someone would be interested in that. Well, thank you so much. Okay. I really, really enjoyed talking to you.
Okay. And as Nathan said, I did.